he admitted. My own personal Rubicon. What I give up for the Marshal's mace, Admiral Tasker, is my general authority over the Commonwealth Navy. I have absolute authority in the Rimward Marches, and am legally forbidden to command Commonwealth forces outside the Marches.
We can't just let the Commonwealth burn, she objected.
No, we can't, he agreed. However, it seems that all of our plans and schemes to thwart this exact kind of attack failed. We need to consider what the final orders we sent to our people were.
Gather at Niagara, Gabor replied, after that slight but all too noticeable delay. All of our secondary forces were heading there.
And that is where the Senate will expect to find us as well, if they do have new orders for us, James reminded them. For now, we will return to Niagara.
What were our plans for this kind of attack? Tasker asked. My people have checked. Every entangled particle block in the fleet is dead, spewing garbage radiation data if they're receiving anything at all.
The Uranus facility was our emergency continuity of government facility, the Marshal replied. Officially, it didn't exist, and only current or former designated flagships even had entangled blocks for it. But the Alliance knew where it was. It was the first one they took out, he noted grimly.
We only had one secret facility? Gabor asked. James chuckled.
We were supposed to have three. One in Seoul, one in Tau Ceti, and one in Sirius.
There's nothing in Sirius, Gabor objected.
That was the point, James's chuckle turned bitter. The program was cancelled after the Uranus platform because we discovered the Federation was building 80 million cubic warships. The budget was put into building the Ambrosias. Not that those seemed to help.
The destruction of both super battleships in the defense of Ceres was one of the confirmed losses from the Battle of Seoul.
We fall back to Niagara and get our prisoners off our warships, he continued.
Niagara had proper POW facilities in orbit, thankfully.
There's too many people with potential access to them while they're aboard our ships.
You don't trust our people? Gabor demanded.
Our prisoners wear the same uniforms as the people who just attacked Seoul, Mihai, James said flatly. Some people are not going to be thinking rationally. We have obligations to our POWs, and we will see them respected.
Even if, in the back of his head, James Walkingstick suspected that Kyle Roberts had more than a little to do with the chaos that had just been unleashed upon the galaxy. Kyle was amused that the man with quite literally life-or-death authority over him still asked permission to enter the tiny quarters they'd locked him in. Unless he missed his guess, the room they'd put him was normally shared by two lieutenants or similarly larval officers, but they'd scooped out a bed in favor of a couch when they decided to put an admiral in there. Even as a prisoner of war, rank had its privileges. They didn't, he expected, actually extend to refusing Walkingstick entry to his quarters, but at least the Marshal asked.
Well?
Walkingstick demanded as the door closed behind him, looking at Kyle like he wanted to ask a longer question. Or potentially, like the Terran officer wanted to strangle him with his bare hands. Given what it sounded like the events of the last 12 or so hours had entailed, that was also quite possible.
Well, what? He asked.
Don't you want to know how your Alliance's grand offensive, the plan I can see your fingerprints all over, went off?
Walkingstick asked. Kyle sighed and leaned back in the couch, gesturing around him. Marshal, I have a data pad that is linked to an entertainment library that has nothing less than 10 years old in it, and four walls that make for a somewhat comfortable prison, he pointed out. At this point, unless an Alliance fleet has arrived and forced you to surrender, the result of the war isn't going to change my fate. He did want to know, but he also didn't. If Medusa had failed, he had doomed his nation and her allies to the dustbin of history. The Terran officer chuckled bitterly.
That hasn't happened. So far as I know, but since I no longer have real-time sensor data...
He shrugged.
Your people did it,
Walking Stick concluded.
You may have single-handedly wrecked the largest human civilization in history, Admiral Roberts. The entire Commonwealth QCOM network is down. Do you have any idea of how many people this will kill?
The Commonwealth requires all of their systems to be self-sufficient in food and basic industry, Kyle replied, pushing down a momentary desire to gloat. I think your civilization will survive just fine.
You saw what happened in Presley, the Marshal told him. A dozen systems will go up in flames now. Maybe two dozen. Ships will mutiny. The Commonwealth will tear itself apart. Millions are going to die, Admiral Roberts. You can argue everything you destroyed was a legitimate military target, but the blood of those innocents is on your people's hands.
And whose hands is the blood of the Kamatians on? Kyle asked. He'd watched a Terran battleship sear that world with antimatter fire. He'd hunted the ship responsible down and destroyed it, and he'd admit the captain had gone rogue. But without Walking Stick's war.
Ours, Walking Stick admitted without flinching. Mine, even. It shouldn't have happened, Admiral Roberts. Unification, bringing all of humanity together, is how we stop things like that. And now... Now you've set more of those flames in motion.
You give me a bit too much credit, Kyle replied. He'd drafted Medusa, but he'd been one of over 30 officers in the Joint Strategic Options Command. And hundreds of thousands of spacers, starfighter crew, and officers had carried out the mission.
Speed, aggression, and shock used as psychological weapons,
Walking Stick said dryly.
I can see the mind behind Tranquility and Hui Xing in this strike, Admiral. Other hands may have carried it out, but I know the fingerprints of the architect.
The Terran shook his head.
You remind me of myself, though with a poorer luck in birthplaces, I suppose, he told Kyle.
What do you expect? Kyle told him. I quite like where I was born, Marshal, but someone wrote a treatise on aggression and calculated risk as psychological warfare in modern carrier combat as a military strategy theory thesis. And it wasn't me. Walking Stick stared at him for a long, long moment.
That should never have left the Commonwealth, he said.
Apparently, it ended up in the Castle Federation's Academy Library, Kyle replied. If I remind you of yourself, Marshal, it's because I read your damn book. They glared at each other for several moments, then Walking Stick sighed and shook his head.
You realize that I can no longer trust my people to take proper care of yours, he admitted. We are returning to the Niagara system, where I will be turning your people over to a civilian prison authority. I believe I can rely on their restraint more than my own people's.
He sighed.
If nothing else, they have a smaller proportion of people actually from Sol, he noted. Attacking the home system has made your alliance no friends, Admiral.
You came for our homes, Kyle told him fiercely. You came for our independence, our freedom, our right to live as we chose. You burned our worlds and killed our brothers and sisters, and you tell me that we have ourselves no friends? Every drop of blood shed in this war, and whatever consequences this unleashes, come back not only to the Commonwealth, but to the man who set this in motion, he snapped, watching Walking Stick recoil in surprise. Your choice, Walking Stick. Your war. You want to blame us for it? Look into God's cursed mirror. For a seemingly eternal moment, their gazes locked again, and then Walking Stick inclined his head in a single, sharp nod, and turned sharply on his heel, leaving Kyle alone in his cell. His Operation Medusa had succeeded, the tide of the war changing. If only he knew what the price was going to be for himself. Chapter 44 Castle System 1500, October 12th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. New Cardiff.
All that Mira Salas really wanted to do was take Jacob and Lisa Kerensky, along with Daniel Kellers, and bury them all in a bubble of soft blankets and armored marines a million kilometers from anything from importance or weight. Since Rear Admiral Mira Salas had a job to do, however, she was in a small briefing room deep beneath Castle Federation Joint Command, as Fleet Admiral Meredith Blake personally briefed the flag officers actively in charge of Castle's defense on the events of the last few days.
All of you are aware that we have spent the last 6 weeks under an unprecedented communications lockdown, Blake told them. That lockdown lifts at 00:00 tomorrow. By that point, all of the Medusa strike fleets will have returned to FTL and be on their way home. Most of those fleets have already withdrawn. What's left of 7th Fleet, for example, held undisputed possession of the Sol system for less than 2 hours before they got the hell out of Dodge.
The mutters around the table were soft, but the words Sol system were repeated too much to not be audible.
Yes, Admirals, you heard me correctly, Blake noted with a smile. Some of you have heard the name Operation Medusa. Few of you in this room were aware of more than fringe elements of it, but I can now brief you on what it involved. We just threw 15 major fleets, totaling over 200 warships, deep into Commonwealth space to attack the key foundations of their communications network. We succeeded.
The briefing room was silent as that sank in.
Succeeded how? Mira asked. As of approximately 00:00 on October 10th, the Terran Commonwealth no longer possesses any functioning QCOM switchboard stations, Blake explained. Their faster-than-light communication network has been destroyed. Along the way, a number of key systems, including the Sol system, at least temporarily fell to our fleets, though most of our attacks were more on the order of raids.
The Federation's Chief of Naval Operations shook her head.
The Battle of Sol should have remained a raid, but it became necessary for the entire fleet to deploy against Terra Fortress Command to extract a portion of Admiral Rothenberg's forces. As of our last update from Sol, TFC and the Commonwealth Home Fleet have been completely destroyed.
She shrugged delicately.
We have reason to believe that a minimum of 20 other capital ships are now headed to Sol and fully support Admiral Rothenberg's decision to withdraw as soon as possible rather than remain to facilitate, say, ceasefire negotiations.
An astrographic chart filled the room.
All 15 strike fleets are being directed to the Via Somnia fleet base, where they will rendezvous with 41st Fleet, Blake noted. Given the damage and losses all of these fleets, including 41st, have taken, Alliance Joint Command is hesitant to commit to further offensive action. If nothing else, it will be 6 weeks before all of the fleets have returned, and damage may force additional ships to be abandoned en route.
How many did we lose? Another admiral asked.
Blake sighed.
Including the loss of Elysium, as Admiral Roberts's endeavors along the frontier were a related operation, we have confirmed the loss of 68 Alliance capital ships.
The room was now very quiet.
None of our major allies escaped unscathed, and many of the smaller powers committed everything they could spare and lost it. In exchange, however, we may have destroyed the Commonwealth, Blake pointed out. We have confirmed the destruction of 96 Commonwealth starships, at least 500 Commonwealth defensive platforms, and approximately 20,000 starfighters. Reports are vague, especially in situations where subordinate task forces were badly damaged or destroyed. But we may be looking at as many as 15 to 20 additional Commonwealth starships destroyed, and possibly as many as 40 sufficiently damaged as to be incapable of offensive operations.
Mira joined the rest of the table in inhaling sharply. That was crippling. The Alliance losses were crushing, a brutal loss that would take years to recover from. But the Commonwealth Navy had just been gutted.
While this may seem like the perfect time to launch a new offensive, I must note that we know Walking Stick has accumulated a striking force of 60-plus capital ships,
Blake continued grimly. Admiral Roberts bought us that knowledge at the highest possible price. There are too few ships currently in Alliance space for us to prepare a counter-operation. It will be 3 weeks before the first Medusa fleets return home, 6 before the last ones do. She paused. We expect to hear from the Commonwealth Star Chamber in approximately 4 to 5 weeks. At that point, whether or not the war will continue will be a political decision. Until then, however, we must act on the assumption that Walking Stick may resume his offensives at any time. He lacks many of the tools we rely on in combat these days, but we would be fools to write him off, Blake said grimly. We have every reason to believe this war may soon be over, but until it is, we must all stand ready to defend our homes. Normally, Mira was driven around by Marines or used an override on the usual transit car network to get around. Today, however, she walked from the towers of the Joint Command to her apartment. Being a flag officer of the Castle Federation Space Navy, that meant that at least 2 Marines had to walk with her. They hung back, though, letting her wander silently through the crowds in Castle's second-largest city. The people around her didn't have the news she'd had. That Operation Medusa had even occurred, let alone been a complete success, was still restricted to the military. That their hero, her fiancé, was dead had been leaked. If the story of the war was impacting the lives of the people around her, that was the one they knew. There were still newsreels feeding what little footage had been given. Someone was advertising a plan to do a documentary on the life of the Stellar Fox. It was all the tasteless garbage she would expect around a hero who'd lived large and died in defeat. Except they hadn't even held a funeral, because no one was even certain that Kyle was dead. And explaining that to a 12-year-old had been one of the worst tasks Mira Salas had ever taken on. It sounded like they'd won the war, but no one could be sure yet. There were still shadows and possibilities that could bring everything down in chaos, but Mira Salas had now read the classified psychological profile that had underwritten Operation Medusa. Without the QCOM network, the Commonwealth couldn't prosecute a war. They might not even be able to hold together as a nation. And if the largest human civilization in history came down in flames and apocalypse after killing her lover, Mira Salas couldn't bring herself to cry for them. Chapter 45. The Asomnia System. 1400, October 13th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. It was a strange sensation to be back aboard Avalon for Michelle. It was an even stranger sensation to be, without question, Avalon's acting CAG. Every Castle Federation Space Force officer senior to her was dead, though, so that didn't leave them many options. Hell, she was the only CFSF Vice Commodore left, Wirt having died in the Leopold system along with so many others. Michelle wasn't even sure how or why she was still alive. But she was. With their losses, most of their starfighters fit on Avalon. Enough had landed on the battlecruisers and the Imperial ships that the big carrier's flight deck seemed empty. Unfilled. If flight control felt strange as she watched the countdown to emergence click down on her implant, it wasn't because the room was different. Avalon and Elysium shared a lot of structure and design, and the primary flight control center looked identical. But the crew was completely different. Her flight controllers had died with Elysium and Admiral Roberts. "Emergence in 60 seconds," someone reported aloud. "Combat Space Patrol ready to go." Via Somnia should be safe. They still had links to the systems there via QCOM, and the crew had been briefed on Operation Medusa this morning. Their sacrifices had held Walking Stick's attention for long enough for the Alliance to sucker punch the Commonwealth. It was worth it. Michelle knew that. Didn't make the empty bunks in flight country hurt less. Didn't make the fact that she'd lost a carrier hurt less. It sure as void didn't make losing the Admiral hurt less. "Emergence!" Avalon's acting CAG had no business on the CSP. Neither did the fleet CAG. That left Michelle in the flight control center, watching 60 of her people go into space without her. In theory, the Insomnia was safe. In practice, they'd stripped it as bare as they could without it being obvious, but there still, thankfully, didn't appear to be any Commonwealth ships here. Hopefully, there was enough equipment left for 41st Fleet's desperately needed repairs. For the second time in barely more than a week, the starships of 41st Fleet tucked themselves into the repair yards at Via Somnia. There were no yard workers to help them out this time, though. The repairs would have to be done by the crews themselves. Gathering aboard Avalon with the other CAGs and captains, Michelle wondered what the news was going to be. No one was even sure who was supposed to be in command of 41st Fleet at the moment. Everything was in question. Elijah Hammond, Avalon's captain, was standing at the head of the room with Lord Captain the Elector Maria von Keita of the Righteous Sword, however, so that was somewhat suggestive.
"Everyone have a seat," Hammond ordered. "I believe now is as good a time as any to pull us all together in person and go over what our plans for the next 4 weeks are."
4 weeks? That sounded quite specific.
"Lord Captain von Keita and I, as the senior captains, have been in discussion with Alliance Joint Command as to what we are going to do from here on out," he continued. "Lord Captain von Keita is senior to myself, so I have officially yielded command to her."
"Avalon remains our largest and most powerful unit, however," von Keita continued as Hammond stepped aside. "So Captain Hammond will continue to act as my second in command until I am relieved. And we have confirmed with Joint Command that I will be relieved," she noted. "What we were briefed on today that has not yet been made public knowledge, even in the fleet, is that the Medusa fleets will be falling back on Via Somnia. All four of the Federation's Myth and Truth-class mobile shipyards are on their way here, as well as an unspecified, but likely large, number of freighters and transports carrying supplies, parts, starfighters, and replacement personnel. The first fleets will be returning in about 19 days. Seventh Fleet, under Admiral Rothenberg, is expected on November 10th. At that point, von Keita smiled predatorially, we expect to have consolidated approximately 100 capital ships in the Via Somnia system to be repaired and rearmed. We hope to have our own vessels fully functional by the time Admiral Rothenberg arrives, she noted. My understanding is that Seventh Fleet took severe damage and may not have a significant number of combat-capable units. Other fleets will be following, however, and while the exact execution date is going to be left to Admiral Rothenberg's discretion, the information Captain Hammond and I have received from Joint Command is that, barring a Commonwealth surrender, the Niagara system will fall before December. One way or another, people, Command intends to make sure that James Walkingstick does not threaten our worlds again.
Chapter 46. Niagara System. 1800, November 8th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Ontario Orbit.
"What in void is that?"
James Kelvin Walkingstick chuckled at the disconcerted tone of his Flagstaff sensor tech's voice.
"That, Specialist, is an Alcubierre Stetson Drive courier ship," he explained, studying the strange, bulging ship on the display.
His neural feed was time-stamping the data, informing him that the Cherenkov radiation pulse of the ship's emergence was over 2 minutes old. The courier's commander had taken no risks with his emergence. Given that he must have left Sol within 2 days of the destruction of the QCOM network and come directly here, that made sense to James. If the message was important enough for that rush, it was important enough to spend the extra hour or so of sublight transit time to not risk having the courier vaporized. To an eye used to the massive, kilometer-plus lengths and solid hulls of modern AS-drive warships and freighters, the courier was strange. The four Class 1 mass manipulators that powered her Alcubierre drive made up roughly 80% of her volume. Massive, bulging spheres attached to a central hull barely large enough to keep the Class 1s from just being welded together. The only part of the ship that remotely rivaled the mass manipulators for size was the engine pods at the rear of the ship. Antimatter engines were already blazing to life, accelerating toward Ontario and the Niagara Fleet Base at 500 gravities. Tier 3 acceleration on a starship. The strange ship had been built to get where it needed to go in a hurry, and had, until a month before, been utterly obsolete.
"We have courier ships?"
McGinnis asked, leaning over her tech's shoulder.
"I figured we were going to be using freighters for messages for the foreseeable future."
"That's going to be most of it," James agreed. "We have 4. They're intended for delivering physical delegations in speed and comfort, not carrying all of the dictates and messages of an interstellar government."
"And they sent one to us," his operations officer said softly. "Well, it's nice to know we're still important, right, boss?"
"Ask me that again in," James checked his sensor feed, "2 hours after I've reviewed their messages."
This had to have been the first courier to have left Seoul. That probably wasn't a good sign. The courier waited until they were within 1 light minute of the fleet base to start sending the complicated electronic challenge and response necessary for James to be able to access the confidential messages. With most of a minute of delay on every transmission, it took over 30 minutes to process the challenges and allow James to open up the official mail. The very first urgent, Marshall's eyes only message was from the Committee on Unification. It was a recorded video, and he linked it directly to his implants. The video put him standing in front of the long table the committee used for their meetings, and something in how they were looking at the pickup suggested the feeling like he was on trial was not unintentional.
"Admiral Walkingstick,"
the man closest to the camera, not, James noted, Michael Burns, the committee's acknowledged unofficial leader, greeted him. The speaker was the senator for Tau Ceti, a chubby albino man named Giorgio Mosselkar.
"By now, we presume you have realized that the Commonwealth Quantum Communication Network is down. We know, with certainty, that every station in the Sol system has been destroyed, including the supposedly secret continuity of government facility at Uranus. We have sufficient information prior to the destruction of facilities in other star systems to be quite certain what happened,"
Mosselkar concluded.
"A series of deep strikes by the so-called Alliance of Free Stars was launched with the specific intent of destroying our communications capability."
He paused, glancing at the other senators and assembly members around him.
"They have succeeded," he said bluntly. "The courier carrying this message also carries a delegation empowered by the Star Chamber to negotiate with the Alliance. We intend to offer a ceasefire in place, returning control of all occupied Alliance systems and recognizing their de facto control of the Via Somnia and Presley systems. That will be used as a starting point for a permanent peace treaty. Your efforts to annex the Rimward Marches, Marshal Walkingstick, are now at an end. You have failed us."
Arguably, they were cutting any chance of victory out from under his feet. James wouldn't exactly call this situation a failure on his part, after all. If they'd done what he'd suggested, the Alliance would have been crushed a year or more earlier.
"A similar delegation has been sent to the Stellar League," Mosselkar noted. "Until we have secured the unity of our own systems, we cannot afford continued external threats and conflicts. We will be forced to negotiate, to make recompense." "We are being forced to humiliate ourselves," the senator said bluntly. "But the Star Chamber recognizes that we cannot save the Commonwealth from the consequences of your war with the Alliance without turning our focus inwards."
"Your war, not our war." Roberts's words about where the Alliance put the blame were suddenly echoing with chilling weight in the back of James's mind. He wondered what the delegation the Star Chamber had sent would do if the Alliance asked for one Marshal Walkingstick's head. Hopefully figuratively, but he wouldn't put literally past the Imperator of the Coraline Imperium, as a condition of permanent peace.
"This will no longer be your concern," Mosselkar told him.
You are to return to Seoul aboard your flagship immediately to surrender your Marshal's mace. Since the Rimwood Marches were the origin of this attack, we will need to debrief you on this enemy. We may need to pull back for now, but believe me, Admiral Walkingstick, there will be consequences for this.
The message ended, and James opened his eyes to study his flag deck again. He'd need to go over what information they'd provided. If nothing else, the courier's sensors would tell him how the Battle of Seoul had gone after the Central Nexus had been destroyed. His guess was not well, though the fact that the Senate was in a position to be sending delegations meant it couldn't have gone as badly as he feared. The Alliance, after all, was apparently not dictating surrender terms from Earth orbit. They were still well short of his worst-case scenario. The real surprise came when the courier ship reached orbit, and a short-range transmission from the captain asked James to come aboard in person. He'd been wondering why the courier ship, designed to drop into a system, launch a data pulse, and be on its way to the next as soon as it got a responding pulse, had come all the way into Ontario orbit. Apparently, it had been to speak with him. A shuttle delivered him to the nameless courier ship, where a pair of Marines were waiting for him to escort him deeper into its plushly appointed VIP section.
"What is this about, Sergeant?"
he asked the senior Marine quietly.
"I honestly don't know, sir,"
the blonde sergeant replied quickly, her gaze refusing to meet his.
"The ambassador wanted to speak to you in person. I don't know why."
James grunted. The Marine clearly knew something, and was under strict orders to say nothing. So far, no one had even told him who the ambassador was. Somehow he wasn't surprised to be escorted into a palatial sitting area and find himself facing the calmly seated form of Hope Burns. The wife of the senator for Alpha Centauri was one of the Commonwealth's leading diplomats. The perfectly composed black woman might be 20 years her husband's junior, but most people who knew them both suspected that she'd pursued and courted the older man to have a senatorial trophy husband, rather than the other way around. James was close enough friends with Michael Burns to know that wasn't far from the truth, but also that the pair were actually sickeningly in love. In private, at least. It would never do for two of the most powerful figures in the Commonwealth's government to hold hands where rivals might see them. The Marines shut the door behind him, and Burns rose to wrap James in a tight hug.
"It's good to see you," she whispered. "It's been a hellish few weeks."
He returned the embrace and stepped back to study her. If Hope Burns had had a bad few weeks, it didn't show. But then, he suspected his own appearance didn't reflect the last month either.
"I have the formal notice of my order to return to Earth," he said quietly. "How bad is it?"
"Bad," she said flatly. "While I have several tiers of specific offers that Foreign Affairs top people went through as a ground, my authority is functionally unlimited."
Unlimited. That was a bad word when applied to the woman sent to negotiate peace.
"No one wanted to use the word surrender," she noted. "But the level of plenipotentiary authority I have been given made it clear that if the Alliance will accept no less, I'm authorized to negotiate a conditional surrender."
"Or an unconditional one," James concluded.
"Or an unconditional one," she agreed. "If that's the only way to get the Alliance to stop shooting at us while we sort out the wreckage from their destruction of our communications."
She sighed.
"Unification is inevitable," she murmured. "But damned if they haven't managed to produce the one roadblock that's going to slow it down a lot. It'll be years before we have even a basic network back up. Decades before we return to what we had."
"Less, surely, if we focus on it," James replied.
"Perhaps. But we are crippled, James. Crippled. The Commonwealth may not survive the next few years. Systems that secede will be able to buy QCOM blocks from the League or the Alliance's members, but no one will sell them to us."
He winced.
"That bad?"
Officially, everyone is happy to be unified, so of course they'll stick with the Commonwealth,
Burns said dryly.
In practice, well, Michael and I have always kept a solid finger on the pulse of the truth of the Commonwealth. By December, at least one system will have seceded. By February, at least one multistellar unit. We won't even learn about the secessions until it's too late to do anything. Coordinating forces to end these secessions will be difficult.
But doable, he pointed out. We have enough older warships to use as couriers to move the more recent vessels around to put out fires. We can hold the Commonwealth together.
And who would command the forces that would do this? She asked. Which admiral would you trust with the knife at the Commonwealth's throat?
He blinked. She was right. The civil war to come would require large forces operating with minimal command and control. They would need officers they could trust completely.
I have several suggestions, he said levelly. Officers whose loyalty I would trust completely.
Burns chuckled softly.
You aren't being recalled to ask for your advice, James, she told him. They told you what? You're being recalled for debriefing?
Exactly, he confirmed,
wondering what she was talking about.
Michael figured they wouldn't have the gumption to tell you the truth. He couldn't tell me what they did say, though.
The truth?
You're being recalled to face a trial before the Senate for grand treason,
Hope Burns told him quietly.
And the Senate has already made up their mind. If you go home, James Calvin Walkingstick, they will kill you.
James found himself noting, vaguely, the details of how palatially the room Hope Burns had met him in was furnished. Most starships had plain metal floors and walls, maybe with a rug in people's quarters. This room was carpeted, and the walls had been carefully painted with a mural of one of Earth's beaches. The furniture, including the chair he was sitting in, was luxuriously comfortable, and the room was being kept noticeably warmer than the rest of the ship. The courier ship crew did their best, it seemed, to pamper the VIPs they carried. All of that was a distraction from what she'd just told him.
"Kill me?" he finally asked. "That's extreme? Why?"
"Because they need to blame someone," Burns said. "Because they can't blame the Star Chamber for voting for this war, so they'll blame you for dragging the Commonwealth into it. They'll claim that if you were actually loyal and competent, the war would have been over years ago. They'll blame you for starting the war, they'll blame you for not finishing the war, and they'll blame you for allowing the Alliance to launch strikes into Commonwealth space," she concluded. "It's all void stuff," she noted. "But they don't care. You're going to be scapegoated for the Alliance's attacks on us, found publicly guilty of treason, and executed."
James shivered.
"Even putting aside the fact that I'd rather not be shot, that's a really bad idea," he said. "They'll undermine the loyalty of every flag officer. If we face execution for losing,
then the entire military structure that we need to hold the Commonwealth together will start fracturing," she agreed. "I wouldn't be sitting here telling you this if I agreed with them, James. Letting them execute you could destroy the Commonwealth. You have to run, James. Send in your mace and resignation and disappear."
"I don't run," he told her. "I never have. I never will."
"It's the only choice you have left, James," she said. "If you go home, they'll execute you. There's no escaping that. If you defy their orders and stay here in command of your fleet, you'll end up accelerating the disintegration of the Commonwealth. You'd end up with your own pocket empire, but I know you, James Walkingstick. You are a loyal son of Terra."
"For which, it appears my superiors now wish to kill me," he replied.
"Yes," she said steadily. "The Star Chamber has betrayed you, James, but they are not the Commonwealth. The best way you can serve now is to disappear.
Walk away before they end you.
There was nothing to say, really. James spent a minute staring at the wall in silence. Burns didn't say anything, just waiting.
Damn it, he finally said.
I appreciate the warning, Hope, but in some ways I'd rather have not known until it was too late.
Chapter 47 Niagara System 0900, November 9th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time Ontario Orbit. It was a small meeting room, a quiet space aboard a battleship which had few such spaces, large enough for the dozen or so people James had summoned aboard St. Michael for this council. Lindsay Tasker and Mihai Gabor had barely met each other before, but the stresses of the last few months allowed them to embrace as old friends. It had been a hell of a war, and that the courier was carrying an ambassador to Alliance space to end it was as much a relief as anything else. Even to James, he had to admit. Commodore McGinnis and Commander Messera were also in the room. The last occupant was a woman that James had rarely met in person, even as he sliced up her command to send her troops all over the galaxy. General Pearl Crisman of the Commonwealth Marine Corps looked like she'd stepped out of a recruiting poster, even in this informal meeting. She was one of the most heavily muscled people James had ever met, even her Marine dress uniform clearly having been modified to allow for her bulk. If there were any spare grams of fat on the 6-foot-tall woman, 40 years of Marine physical training hadn't found them, and if Crisman was perhaps less attractive to most men than other women, she could not care less. Not least, to James's knowledge, because she was happily married to an accountant on Earth who took fantastic care of their 3 children. The 3-star general commanded the 2 Marine deployment groups assigned to his command. Each contained 3 Marine expeditionary groups for a total of 24 divisions per MDC and almost 500,000 Marines per the TOE. The truth was, most of her divisions were under strength, or had been chopped up to 1,000 different purposes, sent out by battalion or regiments instead of division. And one of her subordinates had managed to get the last intact MEG shattered in the assault on Midori. Nonetheless, there were plenty of Marines to hand in Niagara to load aboard the 15 assault transports they still had. If one James Calvin Walkingstick decided to do something spectacular.
People, you're here because there are things I need to explain in person, he told them all. No encrypted comms, no recordings, no virtual meetings. What we are about to discuss is...
He sighed.
What we are about to discuss is arguably treason, he repeated, finishing the sentence this time.
The 5 officers in the room were silent, all of them waiting for him to continue.
I have been advised, by sources that I trust completely, that my recall to Terra is not for a debriefing, he said slowly. The Star Chamber intends to put me on trial for treason, and they've already decided on the verdict and the punishment. When I return to Terra, I am to be arrested, put to a kangaroo court, and shot.
He let that hang in the room for a few seconds of silence.
What has been recommended to me is that I disappear, he admitted. I do not see a reasonable alternative. My intention is to take St. Michael back into Commonwealth space, leave a letter of resignation and my mace aboard her, and leave at a location somewhere between here and there, he confessed. I will not use this fleet to set up a private empire, even if you would follow me. But I cannot blithely stick my head into the noose for the Commonwealth either.
The shocked silence continued. His officers traded concerned looks, thoughtful glances, 1,000,000 pieces of nonverbal communication. But no one spoke. Then General Crisman rose to her feet.
Fuck that garbage, sir, she told him. My Marines will follow your orders to the end. No matter where you send us, if they want to hang you, they're going to go through us.
General, I cannot.
No,
Tasker cut him off.
We will not permit this.
We will not allow you to be executed or to disappear into obscurity. You are our marshal.
If you go back to Terra, you're going back with all of us, Gabor concluded. Together.
If I arrive in Seoul with 80 capital ships and a dozen plus marine transports, that is treason,
James pointed out.
He was touched. He was horrified. Stunned that his people would even offer this. And he was so, so tempted.
If the Star Chamber is prepared to execute you, they are prepared to doom the Commonwealth.
Messera, the most junior person in the room, said quietly.
Even if you go into hiding, someone else will be blamed. They will break the contracts and oaths that hold us together, no matter what. If you do not challenge them, they will destroy all that we are sworn to defend. What else can we do?
The question hung in the air, and everyone in the room turned their gazes on James.
So be it then,
he said softly.
Prepare the fleet to move out. It seems we have a message to deliver to the Star Chamber. We will save the Commonwealth, with or without them.
The civilian prison platform that Kyle and his people had been delivered to was significantly more comfortable than he'd been expecting. It had the same security features as the military POW platforms he'd once sent his Marines to liberate. Dual hull structure with a vacuum moat, automated security, armed garrisons. But the fixtures in the internal prison area were much more comfortable. The main prison yard area of the station even had trees. While there was no space specifically set aside for Wiccans, there were enough of Kyle's co-religionists among the several thousand Alliance prisoners that a small copse had been unofficially designated. He was sitting cross-legged in that copse in the plain gray jumpsuit they all wore now, meditating on a portable electric light. There were no candles inside the prison segment, so he made do as best he could, when he was interrupted by one of the Marines who'd volunteered as the Admiral's bodyguard. Kyle didn't think he needed a guard there, but it made that dozen men and women feel useful, and he could tell already that feeling useless was going to be quite common in there.
Sir, one of the guards is asking for you, she told him. Apparently, the marshal wants to speak to you.
The prison was structured so that it could be run with tight control. Prisoners secured in cells when not specifically allowed out, armed guards everywhere. Or it could be run more openly, with the prisoners mostly moving around of their own accord, but the accesses across the vacuum moat heavily guarded. For POWs, they appeared to have chosen the latter.
All right, he told the Marine, carefully rising to his feet. I suppose I should go see what our captor wants.
He was escorted through the accessway into the outer station. None of the personnel he could see were Marines. Everyone was Niagara System Judicial Wardens, trained specialist prison officers. The wardens had some trouble adjusting to guarding POWs instead of criminals, but in the main, the NSJW's people had taken the task on with aplomb. It was a surprise, however, to realize that Walking Stick was out of uniform. Every time they'd encountered before, the marshal had been wearing full uniform with his insignia and working decorations. This time, Walking Stick wore a simple black ship suit with no insignia. It wasn't like insignia were necessary. There probably wasn't a living soul for 100 light years who wouldn't recognize him instantly. But it was unusual.
Have a seat, Admiral, he instructed, then glanced up at the wardens. Leave us, ladies, he ordered, and turn off the recorders.
Of course.
The guards withdrew.
This is the last time we will meet, Admiral Roberts,
Walking Stick said quietly.
That's not a threat,
he continued instantly, as Kyle began to pull away from him.
It's a statement of fact. Your freedom will be gained shortly, he continued. An ambassador for the Commonwealth is already heading to Alliance space to negotiate a ceasefire and, hopefully, a peace treaty. There is no question in anyone's mind that the prompt and efficient return of all of our POWs, as well as all occupied systems, will be the minimum offer we can make.
Most likely, yes, Kyle said carefully.
That will be arranged between your government, the ambassador, and the NSJWs,
Walking Stick continued.
I am leaving.
So soon? So late? In Walking Stick's place, Kyle would have had his fleet in Seoul already, pledging his undying allegiance to the central government and doing everything he could to keep the Commonwealth together. But then, Kyle freely admitted he didn't understand Terran politics.
The choice is no longer mine, the Marshal told him. It falls to me now to convince my own government that the Commonwealth must be saved. Either they will see the light and save it, or I will find a way to save my nation without them.
Kyle hid his wince. What Walking Stick was saying was quite close to what he'd been thinking, but suggested that the Commonwealth government might not be willing to believe the other man's pledges of loyalty. He definitely didn't understand Terran politics.
So now what? He asked. You and your people will remain here, Walking Stick told him. Once the ambassador has arranged for your release, presumably the Alliance will send someone to collect you.
The Marshal shrugged.
I have done all within my power to guarantee your safety and return, he half-whispered. I owe you that in exchange for justice for Kamadian.
There are those who believe there has not been true justice for Kamadian, Kyle replied. Walking Stick nodded.
Oh, I know. You told me that yourself, he reminded the Federation officer with a forced smile. But I have a duty now. So do you.
The Marshal extended his hand.
I could hate you for what you planned and your people inflicted on my nation, he said softly,
the hand hanging unwavering in the air.
But the reverse is also true. We have done our duty. We shall see where it leads us both.
Kyle hesitated for a few more seconds, then shook Walking Stick's hand. I won't wish you good luck, he told the other man. But I understand.
That, Admiral Roberts, is all men like us can do for each other.
Chapter 48 Niagara System 0600, November 14th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 7th Fleet. Avalon blazed out of the Cherenkov radiation of her Alcubierre Stetson emergence flash with every sensor online, Q-probes flashing from her probe bays and her first cycle of fighter launchers coming alive. Vice Commodore Michelle Williams Alvarez led her people into space, wave after wave of brand-new Reaper-type starfighters. Project Armada's first product had hit mass production just in time for the freighters carrying ships out to Via Somnia to be packed full of the new ships. The new bombers hadn't arrived yet, but the newly repaired and refitted 7th Fleet had been entirely re-equipped with the 8th-generation starfighters. As 100 starships flickered out of Alcubierre Drive around Avalon, hundreds and then thousands of the tiny parasites flared out around them. Between 41st and the Medusa fleets, 215 ships had been sent into Commonwealth space. Only 100 had been fit for combat when Admiral Rothenberg had decided to move out immediately, but with the Reapers, that should be enough.
Ma'am? Eklund said slowly.
There's no fleet here. She paused, studying the tactical feed. 100 Alliance carriers, battleships, and cruisers had emerged from Alcubierre. A second wave of 20 assault transports and another 4 capital ships would arrive in about 12 hours. And they were the only starships in the system. The immense fleet anchorage in orbit of Ontario was empty, though its fortresses and repair yards continued to glitter with electromagnetic radiation.
Defenses are intact, Eklund continued. I'm reading dozens of fortresses and fighter platforms around the fleet base and the planet, but no warships at all. None of the marine transports that should be here. Nothing.
Michelle found herself chuckling at the ridiculousness of it all. They'd brought a fleet that could crush the 80 starships they knew Walking Stick had, and his fleet was gone. Completely.
Well, she said after a moment, that was unexpected. What about the defenses? They're limited to light-speed sensors, Eklund pointed out. They won't know about our arrival for another 40 seconds, and we won't see their reaction for a couple of minutes after that.
He smiled darkly. Best guess is that they have about 3,000 katanas and longbows, he noted. They're doomed.
I wonder if they're prepared to accept the inevitable for once, Michelle asked. I'd rather not be in both the first and last battles of the damned war.
Kyle was awoken by the sound of an argument right outside the door to the slightly nicer cell that his people had insisted become his quarters.
If you do not stand aside, I will have the warden stun you,
an authoritative female voice barked.
I understand what you feel your responsibilities are, but I do not have time for this game.
Since they were only issued the one style and type of garment, dressing had become entirely second nature after 2 weeks. By the time the speaker had finished threatening his bodyguards, Kyle was dressed and flinging open the door to his cell.
What is going on? He asked calmly.
A quartet of wardens and 2 youthful men in carefully tailored black suits were standing off with the 2 Marines outside his door. Those 2 women might have been unarmed, but they certainly looked prepared to throw down with the wardens and the security detail. The 9th person outside his door had probably been the speaker. She was a tall woman with a wide face that looked used to smiling and long dark hair, clad in a suit tailored almost identically to her security detail.
I need to speak to you, she barked at Kyle. Your guard's enthusiasm is commendable, but we have very little time if we are to avoid bloodshed.
Kyle smiled cheerfully. I find myself suddenly extremely willing to hear you out, ma'am, he told her. Your office or mine? His feeble attempt at humor at least calmed his guards and earned him an appreciative nod from the wardens.
No bloodshed here, she told him. Come with me, Admiral Roberts.
He shrugged at his guards and fell in behind her. The assorted security guards fell in behind them, like the tail of a pair of comets, as she led the way.
I am Premier Jessica Nkele,
the dark-haired woman told him as they walked.
The elected representative of the people of Niagara. I answer, of course, to the Star Chamber of the Commonwealth.
I am surprised to see a system executive in my, lack of office, Kyle replied. What do you need?
I need you to talk your people out of blowing my orbitals to hell, she said flatly. There's an entire fleet heading towards my planet, and while I may not be a military woman, I can run the math between 100 warships and 36 fortresses in my head.
Ah. The Alliance was here, then. That was good news, but he could see in Kayle's concern. You realize, of course, that we are still at war.
The ambassador was sent to negotiate a peace treaty, she pointed out. I am prepared to offer Niagara's parole, I think is the term. We won't fight you and won't participate in any future war against you, but your fleet will pick you up and leave. No fighting. No death.
Kyle nodded slowly. Yeah, I can do that, Premier Nkele. Nkele led him across the vacuum moat and into a small office, then linked him into the station's implant network.
You should be able to send a message from here, yes? She asked. I assume you'll want privacy?
If you would be so kind, he agreed. To his surprise, Nkele gestured for her guards to leave and exited the room with them. There was just him and his 2 self-assigned marine bodyguards. You may as well be seated, troopers, he told them. Without QCOMs, this could take a while. He fully accessed the station's systems. Nkele was being true to her word. Not only did he have communications access, he also had full access to the station's sensors. He could see the massive armada bearing down on Ontario. He didn't feel particularly bad for the planet that had spent the last few years hosting the people determined to conquer his home nation. But the war was over. He didn't have it in him to let people die just because that news hadn't made its way around yet. Vice Admiral Kyle Roberts sighed and turned on the pickup.
Alliance Fleet, this is Kyle Roberts, he greeted them. I assume I have been declared missing, presumed dead, but as you can see, I was taken prisoner by the Commonwealth. I have attached my Level 1 authentication sequences to this message. This channel is not secure enough for standard interrogations for Level 2 and higher authentications. My understanding is that the locals will happily deliver me to a vessel of your choice for those authentications.